Everyone, welcome to the November Council meeting. All of the usual housekeeping items, cell phones on silence or vibrate. We will try and take breaks at 90 minutes or closest to that that fits in. Are there any changes to the agenda? Okay, seeing none, we will jump right into the reports section. I'm going to lead off on that. Basically go through the executive committee report, and I've got a couple of other items. The executive committee report is under tab 1, document number 1. The first item was the timelines. I'm not going to go through those. That's tab 1, document 3, if you care to go through them. Item 2, we had a discussion concerning the science workshop, which was held last Friday. And my assumption is Dr. Karp, who is in the process of changing a flat tire, and will be here shortly, will give us an update on that. Item 3 was approve reappointment of SSC membership. We have had one individual who has asked to is resigning from the SSC, Les Kaufman. We will go out and try and replace him. And the other process of reaching out to the rest of the slate of SSC members who are up for reappointment is in the process. There was also some discussion about having an outside person look at the makeup of the SSC and make sure that we had a proper balance between the various specialties on the SSC. We're not going to go ahead with that immediately, but that is something that the executive committee may look into in the future. The fourth item is the review of priorities. We have a section on that coming up, I think, on Wednesday. Thursday, excuse me. So I'm not going to go through that. We will address that then. Five was we had a discussion on joint management of SCUP. The regional office presented us with a draft white paper that we looked at and discussed. We came to the conclusion that for the time being, we had been given, the New England Council has been given two seats on the demersal committee for the Mid-Atlantic, which covers SCUP, and our feeling was we would see how that worked out for this year and then see whether we needed to go into a more complicated joint management program with SCUP. There was, on item 6, a discussion of whether council members could be, and council member documents and correspondence could be FOIA'd. That is under review by the Department of Commerce lawyers, and we do not have a decision on that, but it is something, obviously, that could be of importance to council members. And there was some discussion. This is titled the discussion of the ASMSC GOM winter flounder addendum. Most of the discussion we had was concerning the yellowtail ABC under the TMGC. We will get to that under groundfish. I also want to bring up the fact that we have a dates now for our risk policy workshop. That's been scheduled for March 20th and 21st in Salem, Mass., which is quite appropriate, I think, witchcraft and risk policy. Anyway, that is being organized with obviously the council, the SSC council staff, and we've been getting support from the Sustainable Fisheries Forum. So put that onto your calendars. And that's all I have. I can answer any questions. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question. I'm curious of what the status is of our executive director search. I realize that we're lucky enough to have Paul, but only through March. And just curious what the timetable for that is.
The current timetable is that the executive committee or search committee has made initial cuts. We will hold interviews with the candidates up at the end of November. After that, we are going to have to look to holding a one-day meeting at some point in January for voting council members to interview and make the final selection. So we are moving along. It's to be 3 weeks, and we will do the first set of in-person interviews.
So just along those lines, I'm curious how many applications we received, and when you made that initial cut, the numbers that you started with versus the numbers you're at now.
We received 26 applications. By the time we had a chance to sit down and review those, we were down to 25. From the 25, we selected 6 candidates. The next cut will go down to 3 candidates, which will come before the council. Anyone else? Okay, moving along, Executive Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One quick item. The Northeast Regional Planning Body is going to have their first meeting. That's the group under executive order to start coastal marine spatial planning, and they will have their first meeting at the University of Southern Maine in Portland, November 19th and 20th, and our representative is Doug Grout. So he will be carrying out duties for the council. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? Doug.
Just an update, Paul. They've changed the location to the Clarion up in Portland. Apparently, they're anticipating a larger crowd than before, and they are going to be meeting at the Clarion.
Thank you. And John Bullard.
We had a very successful science forum in Portsmouth, New Hampshire on Friday, and I know that Bill Karp, when he finishes changing his tire, will report in full on that, but this was a joint effort between the council, the regional office, and the Science Center, and I want to make sure that I express thanks on behalf of the regional office to the staff of the council. I'm looking at Pat Fiorelli especially for work in outreach. We had a full house at the Mary. We had, I think, 56 people in the webinar, very robust discussion on it. So I think by all measures, it was a success, a joint effort with all three organizations. So I really thank the council for being a full partner in that. Second item I want to mention before George takes over is that I know everyone is concerned about our colleagues on the Mid-Atlantic Council and the impact of Sandy. We have been working very closely through the ASMFC to assess what the impact has been, and you've all seen the images on the television to New York and New Jersey especially. We've been talking with members of the council in those states. Obviously, those two states, New Jersey and New York, especially hard hit. Governors are requesting disaster declarations through the Department of Commerce as well as otherwise. And so impact on recreational fishing, commercial fishing is substantial. The fleets have been miraculously, I think, spared, but the infrastructure is another matter. It's going to be a long time before power is restored. Marinas, docks, I don't know when they're going to get rebuilt. So I know our thoughts are with our colleagues further south, and I just wanted to let you know that we are we're working with them, but it's not going to be easy rebuilding that area. So with that, George will go down through the details of the what's been going on in the regional office.
Thank you, John. I've got a number of things to go over with the council. The sector operations plans, each of the 18 current groundfish sectors have submitted proposed operation plans for fishing year 2013. We are in the process of developing an environmental assessment, analyzing the proposed operations plans and the exemptions that they've requested, and we'll publish a proposed rule seeking comment on the operations plans and those exemptions. And sector rosters are due to us on December 3rd, 2012. On November 8th, we published a proposed rule to implement a targeted Acadian redfish fishery for sector vessels. This is something that the council had supported and asked that we do as well. This would expand on a previously approved sector exemption by allowing groundfish sector trawl vessels to harvest redfish using nets with cod end mesh as small as 4.5 inches. In addition, it proposes to implement an industry-funded at-sea monitoring program for sector trips targeting redfish with trawl nets with mesh sizes that are less than the regulated mesh size requirement. That proposed rule is on the street, and comments are due on that by November 23rd. At your last council meeting, one of my staff, Travis Ford, briefed the council on a proposed spiny dogfish exempted fishery. On October 19th, we published a proposed rule to do that. This would allow vessels to fish with gillnet and longline gear from June through December and with handline gear from June through August in a portion of inshore Georgia's Bank outside of the requirements of the Northeast Multispecies Fishery. Comment period closed November 5th, and we're currently working on a final rule that would implement that exempted fishery. I'm sure you all remember that on May 1st of this year, we used interim secretarial authority to implement measures designed to reduce but not end overfishing for the 2012 fishing year for Gulf of Maine cod. As you probably recall, we can only put in measures under that interim authority or emergency authority for 180 days. So we published an interim final rule on October 29th, 2012, to extend that the Gulf of Maine cod annual catch limits and the recreational management measures through the end of fishing year 2012, which is April 30th. Days at Sea Leasing Program Summary. Through November 5th, We have approved a total of 8 leases for days at sea in the common pool and 105 for sectors. The total days at sea leased were 102.2 for the common pool, 3,441.82 for sectors. And the average cost of a day at sea leased was $133 for the common pool and about $10 for sectors. In terms of sector ACE transfers, again through November 5th, we've processed a total of 756 ACE transfers for sectors, total of about 17.5 million pounds. The largest transfers have occurred for Georges Bank Haddock West and for Pollock. We have published the notice of availability for your Amendment 19 for small mesh groundfish species. That was published on October 19th. And we published the proposed rule that would implement Amendment 19 on November 2nd. The comment period for the notice of availability, which basically means comments on the amendment itself, closes December 18th. And the comment period for the proposed rule closes December 3rd. On November 1st, we increased the Area 1A sub-ACL for herring from 24,373 metric tons to 27,668 metric tons as a result of the New Brunswick weir fishery landings. Because they were under 9,000 metric tons, we transferred 3,000 metric tons to the Area 1A sub-ACL for the remainder of the fishing year. On November 13th, we published a proposed rule in the Federal Register that would reduce the 2013 annual ACLs for the Atlantic herring fishery to account for catch overages in 2011. You may remember that the way the FMP is set up now, there is a one-year lag between any overage and the payback in the herring fishery. And that overage in 2011 was in Area 1A. The overage was 1,425 metric tons. So this rule would deduct that amount from the Area 1A sub-ACL for 2013. We closed Area 1A herring fishery effective November 5th. And effective that date, there's no directed herring fishery in that area for landing more than 2,000 pounds of herring through the end of this fishing year. We had closed on the basis of landings projections and intelligence from the fishing industry that they expected that date would match up to full attainment of 95% of that sub-ACL. Unfortunately, when the numbers came in, the industry was not able to find the fish in the abundance that they expected they would, and didn't come up to the full 95%. We considered the possibility of reopening that fishery, but when we got our final numbers in at the end of last week, we only had 2,000 metric tons left, and we were concerned about a very short opening in terms of its safety implications and the possibility of the fishery going over and the fact that the fishery's already attained 101% of its total ACL. Bottom line is we did not reopen, and I think we all agree that in the future we need to continue to work to better fine-tune our data management and our communications so that we come as close as we can to the 95% trigger as possible. Something that we spoke about at the NRCC meeting, and I need to bring forward to both councils as a result. You may remember that about a year ago, the agency undertook a look at the vessel baseline replacement omnibus amendment, which had been done, I think, in the late 1990s, to see if there were ways that we could streamline that. Maybe there are things that needed to be changed that were no longer necessary or that weren't working very well. As a result, we published an advance notice of proposed rulemaking in October 2011, and got quite a few public comments as well as comments from the council. They were, frankly, all over the place. Some people thought that we should do away with the baseline requirements altogether. Some people thought we shouldn't touch them at all. There were some issues about maintaining fleet diversity. There were concerns about fishing power in some fleets, particularly the dredge fleets. Anyway, we looked through all the comments, talked again internally, and as a result, we are recommending to both councils that we do undertake an omnibus amendment, which would amend both councils' FMPs to eliminate the tonnage requirement, the tonnage aspect as one of the baseline requirements, both gross and net tonnage, and to remove the one-time upgrade restriction. Right now, for example, if you had a 60-foot vessel and a 10% upgrade restriction on length, you would be able to upgrade one time to something larger than 60 feet. So if you upgraded to 62 feet, you could never go above 62 feet. We think that that's unnecessarily restrictive. It's very burdensome in terms of the agency's administrative requirements and as well as the industry's. So we're proposing to do away with that. So if you had a 60-foot vessel, you could get a 62-foot vessel, and 3 years later, if you wanted, you could get a 65-foot vessel. But before we would undertake the amendment and the analysis, it would be council amendments, but we would take the lead on it, similar to what we've done in the SBRM amendment. We would staff it. We would meet with each of the affected committees to make sure that they're in agreement with what we're proposing and to get any input from them. And then we would bring back to the council's a draft amendment in the summer of 2013. It would probably be your June council meeting. And expect to have a final amendment document for the council's approvals at your October and November meetings for implementation May 1st, 2014. So what we're seeking at this meeting and will be with the MID is the council's okay to proceed with that development of that amendment. It doesn't bind you to approving it ultimately, but it would give us the go to start doing the work on that amendment. Due to Superstorm Sandy, the Harbor Porpoise Take Reduction Team meeting that was originally scheduled to be held October 29th through November 1st was rescheduled. It will be taking place November 27th to 30th in Providence, Rhode Island. There are two renewals of information collections that are required under the Paperwork Reduction Act that I need to make you aware of. There was a notice published in the Federal Register on October 15th requesting public comment on renewing PRA information collection requirements for Amendment 16 to the Groundfish FMP, and you and the public are invited to comment by December 14th on that. Also, we published a notice in the Federal Register on November 14th requesting comment by January 12th, 2013 on paperwork burden estimates for vessel, dealer, and operator permit applications and renewals, applications for limited access programs, VMS requirements, notification to the Northeast Fisheries Observer Program, and applications for letters of authorization under exempted fisheries programs, and applications for the Vessel Single Owner Program. Again, on that one, the comment period is open through January 12th. And although it's not your FMP, I know it's an important fishery in this area, so I will tell you that on November 1st, we closed the recreational fishery for black sea bass for the remainder of the year in federal waters. The available data for the recreational fishery through the end of August indicated that we were substantially over the recreational harvest limit for that stock, and the recreational regulations in that FMP required that we close for the remainder of the year. And that's my report. Thank you.
Thank you, John and George. Questions? David Pierce.
Yeah, John, George, good morning. George, in your report, you indicated that the regional office was involved right now with a review of the post-operational plans for the sectors. Could you provide just a brief summary as to what exactly is looked at when you review those operational plans post-operational?
No, actually, that wasn't what I meant to say anyway. We're reviewing the proposed operational plans for next year, for fishing year 2013.
Okay, then I must have misunderstood you. Regarding the EFP for dogfish, gillnets on George's Bank, are there any restrictions on the use of gillnets in those areas? In other words, are there gillnets that can be soaked for long periods of time, as opposed to what happens inshore, where they basically strike nets, they're set, and then they're pulled right away to minimize the chances of there being any unwarranted bycatch? So any requirements regarding how those gillnets are fished?
You know, I honestly don't remember. I'd have to go back and look at the proposed rule. Any restrictions like that would be in there, but I don't remember having that discussion. So.
Okay. On the card record, on the interim rule and its extension through the rest of the fishing year, I can't recall if the service made any changes in the way the recreational fishery for cod in the Gulf of Maine would be regulated. Is it the same as proposed back May 1, 2012, or was it modified in some way, for example, to account for the new information on discard mortality of recreationally caught cod?
I don't think we made a change, but again, let me go back and make sure that my memory is correct on that.
Okay. And finally, let's see. I believe that you, John, have begun to initiate discussions with the Canadians on trade of haddock for George's Bank yellowtail. Are you in a position to give us any update as to where that stands?
Well, we opened up that discussion several months ago, and the next part of the discussion is at the intersessional, which isn't until February. So it's quite a gap between the first meeting and the second.
Anyone else on the council? Jeff. Dave.
Thank you. I had I have two questions. One was on the take reduction team meeting. Is that meeting, the people that show up for that, is that like a voting body? Is it majority of members present, or how does that work? I mean, we're all aware of this letter signed by six people who say they're not coming because they're mad about moving the Harbor Porpoise consequence closure. Are they essentially just out of the loop then?
I'm not sure how many people are not going to come. I think I'd be surprised if that many people do not come. I know I've met with a lot of people who were not pleased with that discussion and talked to them about the concerns. So I think we're going to get good participation. Only one person has actually resigned from the TRT. So I think we'll have good attendance at that meeting.
Okay, thank you. The second question I had was on the amendment on the upgrades. Maybe I was a little bit unclear. Are we proposing to eliminate the one-time upgrade in length but still keep the overall 10% total, or are we proposing that, as an example, somebody could have a 30-foot boat and go out and buy a 120-foot boat, because they're two very different things?
Well, first of all, this is just to get the ball rolling, so we can talk about the details. But it would do away with the tonnage requirement altogether. It would no longer be considered a factor. So we would be left with horsepower, 20% horsepower upgrade, 10% length upgrade. That wouldn't change. But the requirement you can only do it once would go away. So you could, if you want to get a bigger boat, smaller boat, a bigger boat again, as long as you stayed within your 10% upgrade for length or 20% upgrade for horsepower, you'd be good.
That was the question I had. The 10% overall length requirement still stays. So
right.
If you have a 40-foot boat, you could go to a 44 maximum. You couldn't go to a
100-foot. There's enough concern about maintaining fleet diversity and the requirement that there be some kind of constraint on fishing power, particularly in horsepower and dredge fisheries, that we didn't feel comfortable going any further than that. But, again, this is just to get your go-ahead with developing this, and each committee will be able to ask its questions and have its input through the process.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else on Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, George. Just a sort of a comment. With all the discussions about monitoring herring and the closures and things like that, and conversations with your staff, they had said that they had contemplated perhaps planning for an outreach meeting with the industry. And I think this concept came up during the development of Amendment 5, and Amendment 5 actually has some language in there that's rather vague. And it didn't occur, but I think we have some time to contemplate perhaps doing it early in 2013. I think there is a lot of confusion on the part of the industry about how the process works, and I just wanted to comment and say that we should try to continue that effort, and if there's anything that I can do to help your staff get a meeting like that together, I'd be happy to do it.
Anyone else on the council? Jeff.
Read that. Well, when I read that notice, it seemed to me that Area 2 closed at 68% in the final numbers. I just wanted to note that. Maybe we can discuss it in the herring meetings today. But when I remember that table, in terms of where we were on the areas, the four areas, it looked like 2 only got to 68. We closed it in February. So I just wanted to note that as a possible area of concern. Because that was a pretty low number. I just tried to find it. I think Maggie sent the notice out last week, and I'm still trying to track that down. But that's a problem if that's the case. Thank you.
Oh, we can look at that, but I don't think that can be true, because I was told as of Friday that the total ACL for the fishery was at 101%. So. Although there may have been underages in certain places, there were overages in others, and the total amount of fish caught were greater than the ACL. So I'm not sure what you're referring to. I mean, we can look further.
Well, I got to go back and look at the notice, too. I'll make sure I do that, try to find it before this afternoon.
Okay.
Thanks, George. Yeah. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you. We will move on to NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm pleased to announce that technically we don't have any new lawsuits challenging our activities here. However, I would like to bring you up to date on a challenge to that was originally brought around 2008, a challenge to the scallop biological opinion that was prepared in conjunction with scallop fishery measures. This is a challenge to the National Marine Fisheries Service involving the biological opinion. It doesn't directly affect any activity or any measure that the council has taken, but it could potentially affect how scallops are managed. The Oceana, which is the plaintiff in this original lawsuit, filed an amended complaint in November, November 6th of this month. And they have five counts in connection with their challenge to the scallop biological opinion. And by the way, biological opinion is done under requirements of the Endangered Species Act when federal activities may affect endangered or threatened species. And federal agencies are required to analyze the potential impacts of federal activities as to whether they may jeopardize the continued existence of the endangered or threatened species, and or whether there are measures that will mitigate impacts so as to find that there's no jeopardy in that regard. And so the National Marine Fisheries Service has been has completed scallop biological opinions with respect to the endangered ESA biological opinions in connection with the scallop fishery over the years, and has updated them as well. In the new amended complaint, I'll just briefly go over some of the counts. I'm not the attorney handling this and not that steeped in the details of this lawsuit, but the amended complaint challenges the reliance of the agency on what Oceana considers an unlawfully narrow interpretation of the definition of jeopardize the continued existence of a species. Count two is a claim that the agency failed to set enforceable take limits that are measured, the take limits of primarily loggerheads, I believe, turtles, that are measurable and enable the agency to assess whether it's in compliant with the incidental take statement. Incidental take statements are part of biological opinions, and they allow a certain level of take that would not be considered an illegal take as long as it's within the scope of the biological opinion. The third count is a failure to require adequate monitoring of takes in the dredge fishery and the trawl fishery. The fourth count is failure to consider Oceana's 2007 comment letter as part of its duty to consider the best scientific and commercial data available. And the fifth count is a claim that NIMS failed to consider cumulative and aggregate impacts on loggerheads in their analysis of jeopardy, particularly in connection with cumulative impacts of all federal fisheries on loggerhead turtles. By the way, the fourth count that I just described also involved claims that there was failure to adequately analyze global climate change impacts with respect to the biological opinion. So there's a briefing schedule for this amended complaint that basically goes through April of next year, and so I'll keep you updated as to the status of that particular challenge. The agency is in settlement talks with Oceana concerning their, by the way, most of these lawsuits are brought by Oceana, as in settlement talks challenging the agency's approval of last year's sector operations plan approval, as particularly with respect to the at-sea monitoring levels that the agency considered to be required of sector vessels. If the settlement talks do not result in a settlement agreement, then we have proposed, and the court has adopted, a briefing schedule which will start at the end of the month and go through around February 1st, after which the court will then consider the briefs with respect to this lawsuit. So that's an ongoing situation. We are still awaiting the decision in the appeal of the challenge by mostly fishing industry plaintiffs to Amendment 16 in the groundfish FMP. The arguments have been held, the oral arguments before the Federal Appeals Court were held, I think, in September, and we're awaiting a decision in that case. There's three cases in which we continue to operate under a remand mode where the court has found either that the agency and the council need to address certain aspects of their actions. One is with respect to accountability measures, the adequacy of accountability measures brought in a or brought up in a challenge by Oceana to Amendment 16. We're dealing with the remand and the court order, the remedial action in the Flaherty versus NOAA case on challenging Herring Amendment 4, which will be discussed more at this council meeting. And we're also developing the omnibus SBR amendment as part of the remand in the challenge by Oceana to our standardized bycatch reporting methodology. Another lawsuit that's still pending out there is one brought by Midcoast Fishing Group, which challenged, and this is back, I think, in 2005 or 6, which challenged the agency's denial of a petition for rulemaking to close groundfish areas to herring midwater trawls. This case is under consideration. I mean, all briefs have been filed. A magistrate was assigned the case and recommended to the full court that that the agency should go back and fill in whether there is possible concerns about bycatch of groundfish from the herring fishery. But the district court judge that considers the magistrate's recommendation has not yet ruled on that case, so that's still pending. I think that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Are there questions for Gene? Thank you. We will now move on to the Science Center. Are you ready, Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apologize for being a little bit late this morning and my hands being a bit dirty, but I actually did plan to be here on time. Jim cannot be here this morning because he has a conflict, so he's asked me to give the report. So I guess what that means is that they're trying to take the training wheels off and have me do the job, which is a good thing. I'll talk to you a little bit about surveys that are going on or have recently been completed, and then a little bit of feedback from what happened at the NRCC, the meeting that took place a couple of weeks ago relative to plans for assessments in the coming year. Later this afternoon, I have a slot on the agenda to talk to you about the Center's strategic planning, so I'll be back for a little some more discussion later today. I understand that John made some mention of Friday's industry science forum, and I just wanted to say a few words as well as a start. I would just like to thank everybody who participated. Many of the people in this room were there, and I really appreciate the support from many different sectors of the industry and many individuals. And I was very pleased with the way that things went. I'm not at all surprised that there are still many significant differences which we have to recognize and we have to work through. But I do feel that this was a very useful first step in opening up lines of communication and in identifying certain specific areas which we really do need to focus on. I'm going to be working over the next week or so with my staff to develop some priorities based on what we heard and where we think we should go, and to use that to engage further in a dialogue with regards to how we can address some of these ongoing issues of mutual concern. But again, my thanks really to everybody for engaging in a very positive way and in a respectful way, and I hope that we can maintain that standard in our communication in the future. I think that we've got a lot of gains to make, but I feel very optimistic after that session. A little bit about surveys. The Atlantic Statesman Fisheries Commission Shrimp Survey, which was conducted in the summer, finished in late August. The news from that is that the catches were similar to those in previous years, except for small males, which seemed to be underrepresented this year and could indicate poor recruitment in 2012. And certainly that's not inconsistent with, with other news we have about the condition of the shrimp stocks. The annual Order Multispecies Bottom Trawl Survey, the Bigelow Survey, is on its fourth and final leg, and that's going to end this week, and progress has been made as expected. The annual Herring Acoustic Survey began in September, and the final leg ended last month. I think we've talked a little bit before about the challenges that we've had with incorporating data from the acoustic survey in the stock assessments. And we are concerned about the value of the data from that survey and feel the need to take some time to really look carefully at the methodology and the time series that has been developed so far, and potentially to make some course corrections so that we can improve the value of that survey to the assessment. So with that in mind, we actually will not be conducting the acoustic survey in 2013, taking a year to really review and consolidate. But I'm more than happy to talk more about that either during this exchange or with individuals who have any particular concern. The ECOMON, the Ecosystem Monitoring Survey, conduct the fall version of that survey, is also about to be completed. This is a survey that carries out a suite of ecosystem monitoring studies, including plankton, fish larvae, and a large range of physical and chemical parameters. It's particularly interesting to be carrying it out this year. We're collecting some data off of New Jersey and Long Island. Okay. And that will give us some opportunity to see whether we can actually pick up any signals from the impact of the recent storms. We're also looking actually for some additional sea days so that we can do some more focused research in that area. But that really speaks to the surveys. Assessments, as I mentioned, we held the fall NRCC meeting a couple of weeks ago and talked about upcoming assessments, and I'd just like to mention what the plans are for the balance of this year and then into 2013. The SAR 55 is taking place now, or at least the preliminary meetings. The assessment peer review will take place in the first week of December. And that, of course, is for Gulf of Maine cod and Georges Bank cod. So that's a very important one for reasons that everybody in this room understands. At the beginning of 2013, in February, we have SAR 56, planned, and that will look at white hake and Atlantic surf clam. SAR 57 later in the year it is proposed. We haven't finalized yet, but we will likely be looking at striped bass and summer flounder. And then potentially in the second half of 2013, northern shrimp, tilefish, and butterfish. So that's in a nutshell the SAR plans for the balance of this year and next year. Also, under the track, there will be an Eastern Georges Bank cod benchmark early next year, and then the normal track assessments for Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail later in the year. We will be doing stock assessment updates for bluefish, black sea bass, scup, dogfish, skates, monkfish, and ocean quahog. Ocean quahog, I still haven't been here long enough to get that one right, and mackerel potentially later in the year, but those are still under discussion. Another point that I wanted to mention here was one with regard to potential use of electronic monitoring as a supplement for observer monitoring. I know that we received a written inquiry from the council in June, just before I left for the summer, before I relocated, identifying a desire to move forward with electronic monitoring and encouraging us to really take the challenge of developing that capability. It has been challenging to do that. There's been a lot of work done both in this region and nationally to evaluate the potential for electronic monitoring and the extent to which it can actually meet the information needs for management science and compliance. The good news is that it really is receiving national attention at the moment, and there's been a number of draft policy papers generated within the agency which are under discussion and which will be reviewed when the Leadership Council, which is the center directors and the regional administrators, meet in Seattle later this month. And so, if you're willing, I'd like to delay providing a detailed response to that question until we've had the chance to have that discussion at the leadership level and a follow-up discussion between the center and the region, which I'm confident we can do before the end of this year, and so that early next year we can come to you with a more comprehensive view of where we think we can go and the kind of planning that's necessary to get us there. I think that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Are there questions? David Pierce and then Terry Alexander.
Yeah, Bill, you took off the training wheels and you got on the racing bike. So thank you for that very detailed account of what's going on at the center. I just have one question, and it pertains to an issue that will be preoccupying this council tomorrow and the day after, perhaps, and that's Georgia's Bank Yellowtail, the status of Georgia's Bank Yellowtail. I understand that the center, with you in that leadership role, did something that we greatly appreciate, my agency does, and that is you have met with SMAS researchers regarding some work that was done back in 2009, 2010 or so that is reflected in a master's thesis by former council staff member Jessica Megley. And this is that tagging experiment to estimate population size of Georgia's Bank Yellowtail flounder in the closed area, with the results needing to be reviewed, needing to be looked at in the context of where we stand right now with the current likely ACLs for the upcoming fishing year. So my understanding is that you had a meeting with SMS researchers who presented the information to you. Could you give us an update as to where that discussion is at this moment, since, again, it will have, I suspect, some great relevance to what we do come May 1, 2013.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pierce, thank you for the question. I had a feeling that we might have some opportunity to discuss this. This study was conducted in 2008, and it was a master's thesis research by Jessica. It was a mock recapture study. As you mentioned, the staff from the Science Center and from SMAS met to discuss this on Thursday, and I got a very brief report just as I was leaving to go to the forum on Friday, and I'm actually expecting to get some more details within the next little while, so hopefully we'll be able to answer some further questions or in a little bit more depth later in the week. As I understand it, the work was considered as a source of data for the track assessment in 2010, and the assessment group felt that it did not bring useful information to the assessment at that time. Now, at that time, of course, the dynamics of the stock or the perceived dynamics of the stock were different than the perceived dynamics of the stock today. And so we are concerned that this study be given additional scrutiny relative to the quandary that we find ourselves in now. As I understand it, but again, I do need some elaboration on this from staff, there was an agreement that this study should go back before the track for consideration as an assessment data source, but that would happen in the normal track cycle. Because, as you know, it's a single piece of information which has not been peer-reviewed, and our ability to recognize the signal from one source in this kind of complex assessment process, absent and not engage in the process is really a challenging part of this. It is clearly something that deserves attention. On face value, it suggests that there may be more fish out there than we think. But it's also a mock recapture study, and mock recapture studies are notoriously sensitive to assumptions relative to the survival of tagged fish and the dispersion of those fish. And that's an area that I'm particularly concerned that we pay attention to in evaluating the value of this piece of science in the larger array of information that we have that's relevant.
Thank you, Dr. Karp. I appreciate the fact that the center, you in particular, will be giving this work some scrutiny. And indeed, what you said is quite true, that the TRAC, when it reviewed the report a few years ago, said at the time it wasn't that useful, but now things have changed rather dramatically. And in going over the results of the TRAC, they say many positive things about that particular piece of work that involved center researchers. Of course, Chris LaGault was on her committee. He's the chair of the SSC, and he's the George's Bank Yellowtail Flounder guru at the center. So I'm hopeful that this indeed will get that scrutiny very soon, and I fear that if indeed we wait until the TRAC is held, this very relevant and very persuasive, comprehensive tagging experiment will actually have some effect on what we do for May 1, 2013 in light of what awaits us, likely shutdown or almost complete shutdown of the Georges Bank scallop fishery and the groundfish fishery on Georges Bank, an incredibly undesirable outcome. So if this work can help inform this council and certainly the National Marine Fisheries Service as to whether those numbers, so that number needs to be revisited for May 1, 2013 with the Canadians, and I would hope that can be done. Waiting for the track could have a very undesirable outcome relative to the impact of the perilously low ACL we might have for 2013. So, again, thank you for that attention, and please continue to give it a close look.
Terry?
My question was about the forum last Friday. Just kind of curious what your next step is and if you actually got what you thought the common theme was from the industry to you.
Mr. Chairman, Terry, good question. I think there are a number of themes, if you will, that I need to pay attention to. The first one clearly is just one of communication, listening, understanding what people's concerns are, being able to respond. The others, in terms of the specifics, of course, have to do with the assessments and the surveys that inform the assessments. And I think in both of those cases, there's a need to better inform and engage and potentially to look at where we might need to make some changes. I can't at this point commit to precisely, you know, where I think things will go. I can say that my mind is open, even though I really do believe that the process that led to the design of the Bigelow survey and, in general, our assessment process are open processes which are designed to engage the industry and all stakeholders, there's a need for some course corrections. We've worked under the assumption that these constructs work. We've worked under the assumption that once we've completed something, that there's no obligation on our part to revisit and re-engage in discussions. The Bigelow is a good example of that. And so those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about. There were some ideas that were put on the table at the end of the day, some very good ones relative to engagement, some that relate to staff spending more time on the docks and on industry vessels, some that relate to potentially designing a new flatfish survey, which would use industry vessels, and I'm very keen on that idea, and I'm looking for a way actually to work with SMAST and the industry on developing that concept and hopefully seeking some funding. And then in the assessment process, we don't want it to be any more mysterious than it has to be. We do want people to understand what's going on, and we need to figure out how to do that, and I'm really open to ideas that people have in that regard.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, on the review of the electronic monitoring, I mean, I support that. I think it's a good idea to wait. In addition to the biological aspects, though, are they going to look at both the enforcement capabilities, the enforceability capabilities, and the total cost. In other words, if you're going to use electronic monitoring for enforcement, there's a cost associated with that. So I'm interested in whether they're going to just look at the biological applicabilities, you know, can we identify the discards, or are they going to look at the enforceability and the cost associated with it?
Mr. Chairman, David, the idea is to look at it comprehensively, and we do already have a draft perspective from enforcement, and also one that looks at some of the rather complex confidentiality issues. Cost as well, and cost is a really complex one because it's not just, of course, the acquisition and maintenance of the equipment, but the processing of the video records and the the intensity of the processing, whether all the records have to be reviewed, whether there's a way to subsample, focus on particular subsets for auditing or whatever. But those aspects are all part of what we're wrestling with at the moment.
That's good. I appreciate that, and I look forward to that report, because when we reviewed this at the Research Steering Committee, and it was a while ago now, 4 or 5 years ago, I think, these were all items that came up, and we couldn't put a handle on them because we didn't have the information at the time.
Tom Dempsey.
Thanks, and thanks, Bill, for all of your comments. With regards to the electronic monitoring issue, how familiar are you and is your team drawing on lessons or best practices in other fisheries? I know just recently, I think the halibut and sable fish fishery just signed a contract for electronic monitoring for a subset of that fleet. Are you aware of and actively following or tracking and perhaps coordinating with peers to the West in both the Pacific and the North Pacific as they sort of implement electronic monitoring in some of their fisheries?
Mr. Chairman, Tom, yes, I actually did some work on electronic monitoring in the halibut fishery a couple of years ago together with various individuals from different organizations within that region. And so I am familiar with that particular challenge, and I also actually ran the North Pacific Groundfish Observer Program for a number of years in my checkered history. And so I'm very familiar with the monitoring challenges there and the extent to which EM is beginning to be used. Similarly, I know at least superficially what's going on in the Northwest. And part of the discussion that's going to happen at the Leadership Council later this month is really one that cuts across the different regions to try and identify best practices and build on collectively what we've learned.
John?
I think my expertise in this is way, way low, but the point I want to make is that electronic monitoring is a tool. I mean, the expert is certainly Dr. Carr, but this connects as well to the Observer program, as Tom knows, and many of you know. And when I met last week or the week before with the sector managers, the cost of the Observer program was the thing that the sector managers wanted to talk about more than anything else. And whether the industry pays for it or the government pays for it, it's a very high cost. And so as we look at a technology like electronic monitoring, we also have to look at the system that gets employed, and we will have to involve, it seems to me, the council, because the fishery management plans need to be brought into play, because right now, if you look at the observer programs, most of them require, you know, end up with, you know, 20% to 30% observer coverage, which means we have, I would say, a product that isn't very good at the end of this. It costs a lot of money, and it isn't very good. And if we got a product that resulted in 100% coverage, then all of a sudden you end up with something that allows a quota that can be based, that can greatly reduce what you have to deduct for discards, because there's no uncertainty, or there's greatly reduced uncertainty for discards because you've got 100% coverage. So the main point I want to make is that, as Bill has said, this is a priority of NOAA Fisheries. It's a major effort. It's not going to happen in a year or two, but it will involve the work of the council in doing this, I think, to be effective, because the management plans will have to reflect this, and so you all will be involved in this as well.
Further questions? Terry.
I think that we focus too much on discard rates and how many more fish we're going to get out of the fishery if we have 100% observer coverage, because, you know, our discard rates are, most of them are less than 2%, 1%, you know, and unless the observer's charging us $40 a day, we're better off to take the assumed discard rate than the observer. So, I mean, that's where the cost benefit isn't there for the industry to look at.
Anyone else? Okay. Bill, on behalf of the council, I also want to add my thanks to you and your staff and all of the staff who worked on the science workshop. I was in attendance, and I thought it went extremely well. So thank you. We will move on to Mid-Atlantic. Frank.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't attend the meeting. It was a very light agenda. Major thing of concern for the New England Council will be the spiny dogfish, and we'll take that up tomorrow morning. So, I don't know if anybody else was there that had any dad.
Any questions for Frank? Move on to the Coast Guard, Captain Nicola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if my slides are ready, Karen, but I'll just go ahead and provide the presentation. During since the last council meeting, the period 1 September through 9 November, we conducted 235 boardings, issuing two violations. There you go. Thanks. They're an observed compliance rate of 99.1%, which is roughly in the ballpark of the last reporting period. Next slide, please. The other same 235 boardings, 64 violations to 33 vessels. Oh, sorry, that background didn't really work out as I had intended. Reserve compliance rate of 85.9%, again, the same ballpark for the last reporting period. With respect to safety exams, the numbers you have there, 306 exams in September and 512 exams in October, represent respectively a 250% increase and a 500% increase in exams during the same period last year. So a lot of people are getting it done, meeting that deadline, which is a good thing. Right now, and pre-Sandy, all of our sectors in the Northeast reporting no wait times. Boston issued 6 extension letters, but not a very long wait time. But again, I'm not sure how long you'd have to wait in New York for a fishing vessel safety exam these days. Things are still pretty hectic down there. But so far, our extra staffing and outreach are meeting demand. And if that changes, we'll keep you apprised. Next slide, please. We responded to 37 fishing vessel casualties and 9 medical evacuations during the period. Wow, that didn't work at all. Assisted 78 fishermen, 3 safety terminations, which is a pretty low rate. Typically, we get a high termination rate from folks fishing on commercial bluefin tuna licenses. The bite's pretty far offshore this year, so hopefully that's the folks that are going out there are taking their safety gear with them, which is a good thing. Next slide. There we go. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. I'll happy to take any questions from the council.
Are there any questions?
I have a few on how to do PowerPoint, but I'll pass that on.
Thank you. Okay, we will move along to no enforcement VMS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Logan Gregory, NOAA Fisheries Office of Law Enforcement, Northeast Division. During this reporting period, actually as of November 2nd for the year, we have documented approximately 862 incidents. Approximately 80% of those are Magnuson Act type incidents. 12% are Lacey Act, 4% are Marine Mammals Enforcement, and 2% Endangered Species Act. We've had a number of outreach events as well. Since January 1st of this year, we've conducted 399 patrols, 305 different outreach events, 50 meetings, and 60 other types of outreach and activities. The outreach also includes our VMS team. We had 305, but if we were able to add in the VMS outreach, that would probably be at least double that or more. We're working on a new phone system now. We have some new routing for our phones that hopefully we'll be able to count every single call that comes in to the VMS staff. So that will hopefully give us some idea of what we're getting. For the Northeast Observer Program enforcement, there have been very few complaints. Approximately 98.5% of all selected observer trips were completed without reported enforcement need. We have currently two ongoing refusal investigations, four ongoing harassment investigations, one ongoing interference investigation, one ongoing safety case, and one ongoing observer gear sample tampering case. Again, these are all ongoing. It doesn't mean that they've actually occurred. They're under investigation, so they're just complaints at this time. We've had absolutely zero assault complaints, so that is a good thing, and we're very pleased with that result. So far this quarter, from September, we have submitted, 21 cases to the Office of General Counsel. 14 of those cases are Endangered Species Act right whale speed enforcement cases. Six Magnuson Act cases involving improperly tagged trap gear, exceeding silver hake possession limit, violation of the sea scallop access area and the Hudson Canyon access area, violation of sea scallop access area in the elephant trunk, fishing in the EEZ without federal fisheries permit, and export or transport and foreign commerce B-notched lobsters and undersized lobsters. In comparison to the same quarter in 2011, our complaints are exactly the same. We had 48 this quarter. We had 48 last quarter. The number of inspections last year during the quarter were 57. This year is 169. The number of investigations last year, 53. This year, 78. And our disposition of incidents, in 2011, we had cleared 150 incidents. This year we have cleared 245. Last year we had still 11 ongoing incidents, and this year we have 61. So pretty busy these days. I think that's in no small part to the enforcement officer program and working with our state partners and the Coast Guard. We've had a lot of good joint investigations and patrols lately, so hopefully that's going to continue. I'm hoping to hire a new supervisor enforcement officer at some point. I don't have a time frame as to when that may occur. And I don't know if the council has heard yet, but the Office of General Counsel is planning to hire two enforcement attorneys. They will be in Gloucester. Those positions are out in a vacancy announcement, and it closes on, I have it here somewhere. This is why I don't like printing double-sided. Closes on 23 November. So hopefully we'll have those enforcement attorneys in place sometime early next year. So that concludes my report. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Logan? Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Logan, is anyone tracking the amount of time from the potential violation to, you know, to it's finally resolved with a fine or not?
We are not currently tracking that, but we can. We have the capability of doing that. It varies depending on investigation, also depending on the source of the initial investigation. So sometimes it takes time for us to get it, and then we have to add on to that. So I could get it, but I don't have it handy. It's something that we could do, though.
Anyone else? Thank you. Bill.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Semru, the VMS Program Manager for the Northeast Region within the Office of Law Enforcement. And I get to talk a few minutes about my favorite subject, VMS. We have 1,024 vessels that are currently registered in the Northeast VMS program. Of these, 66 have a NMFS authorized letter of exemption to power down their VMS units. And of these 66, 28 of those are sector vessels. We released a new version of the Northeast VMS software last month to all Boat Tracks and SkyMate vessel owners. There was an announcement in the NOAA Fisheries Navigator edition of November on the back page here. There was also a Northeast Region bulletin, which was mailed asking that all vessel owners and operators begin using the new software for trips on or after November 1st. SkyMate mailed its software client version 3.944 on October 16th. Owners were instructed to load the new disk on the laptop connected to their SkyMate satellite communicator. This is the typical method for loading SkyMate software. I would like to use this opportunity to remind owners and operators to please upgrade your software. The VMS team is reaching out to those owners whose vessels have sailed since November 1st using outdated software. Currently, there are 67 SkyMate vessels that have failed to upgrade. And surprisingly, 40 of those are sector vessels. Boat Tracks performed an over-the-air upgrade of the new software macros on October the 31st. Owners and operators only needed to verify that the new macros were received on their Boat Tracks unit. If their declaration macros show version 14 and their forms macros show version 9, then they have the latest macros. With the previous macros, Boat Tracks operators were used to going to macros 19, 20, or 21 to make their groundfish declaration. The new macros are set up differently, however, and that was addressed in the Northeast Bulletin letter. The sector declaration is at macro 20, and the common pool declaration is at macro 21. Macro 19 is now simply a listing of notes that are referenced by the other declaration macros. Based on some of the phone calls we've been receiving, I suspect there is the occasional communications disconnect between owners and operators. The Northeast Bulletin mailing with the new software instructions, as well as the SkyMate software, are all sent to the owner. On the other hand, the operator, who may not be the owner, is the one responsible for navigating the new software. I am exploring ways to reach the operators, as well as the owners, to try and shore up any future problems. Earlier, I mentioned only the Boat Tracks and SkyMate owners were sent new software. Unfortunately, we were unable to get the new software out in time for the Tron vessel owners. While these make up a very, very small percentage of the fleet, nonetheless, they should have the same software and the same improvements and flexibility that the new software offers. Quite simply, the vendor failed to provide us with a good product by the deadline. We continue to test their software and provide them feedback. We're getting close to a final product, but I'm not ready to announce a release date yet. I've got one other issue I'd like to address. Earlier, Dr. Karp mentioned that electronic monitoring has national attention. And I've been watching an issue for some time now that could change the course of the national VMS program in its support of electronic monitoring and real-time data collection initiatives. I know this issue has the attention of those I've spoken to at the region and the Science Center, and it may be of interest to this council as well. I reported to the council some time ago about the SkyMate SM250 VMS. The SM250 is essentially a Dell laptop with all its external ports sealed. It's a closed unit. It connects to the SkyMate modem or satellite communicator, and that's it. It serves one purpose, and that's to send data from the VMS software and communicate to NIMS through email. The SM250 was not built with the idea of being able to connect to any third-party software, such as Flounders for sending electronic VTRs, or to be able to load VMS software locally, whether it be by disk or thumb drive. The SM250 is nationally type-approved, and it's being operated in Alaska, the Northwest, and the Southeast. It is not type-approved in the Northeast region because I've yet to recommend it to Mr. Bullard. But it is becoming an issue for the Northeast since we have vessels with dual permits that must report through VMS to both the Northeast and the Southeast. It's important to know that this is not a SkyMate issue. Rather, it's an issue about VMS type approval standards. Understandably, OLE's primary concern and direction is that the VMS be secure and therefore closed from external sources that could corrupt the data. However, since the introduction of Groundfish Amendment 16, the Northeast has taken the bold step of using the VMS satellite network to support the sectors for real-time reporting of catch and other data via third-party software. Recently, I spoke with John Witzik, the Assistant RA for Fisheries Data Services, and Joan Palmer at the Science Center. And both agreed that, quote, agency leadership is keenly interested in expanding our capabilities in the area of electronic monitoring. The VMS is a data collection technology and an agency asset. Locking the system would put it beyond the reach for providing flexible solutions for the collection of information vital to the management of our nation's fisheries. I've shared their input and concerns with OLE headquarters. Now, regardless of what the type approval standards say, it's known that VMS units in the field, not just in the Northeast, but nationwide, have varying capabilities with regard to external connections. For example, within the Northeast study fleet, and in some groundfish sectors, there are boat tracks vessels also running Flounders or Easy Hail software from an onboard PC. That PC connects to the boat tracks port that is normally closed, but can be remotely opened for authorized vessels. The data from the third-party software is then transmitted through the VMS satellite network. I'm in a unique position here. I work for OLE, I support OLE's mission, and I'm obligated to follow its policies. But I also support the mission of the Northeast program, or the Northeast region, excuse me. Much of the VMS software is driven by Northeast regulations. The data collected by VMS is used extensively by the Northeast region. I see both sides, and I understand both sides. I believe that with the right level of collaboration, we can achieve the needs of both. That is, we can maintain the needed security, not compromise the data, but also expand VMS to support electronic monitoring initiatives. I feel that the VMS program is at a crossroads. There's an opportunity right now to work with the national VMS program to redefine or clarify the requirements as we look to the future of electronic and remote monitoring. Mr. Chairman, this completes my report. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Are there questions for Bill? None. Thank you. Thank you, Logan. The next item is ASMFC. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn to Janice Plant to give the report. As you know, Janice attends only ASMFC meetings and reports splendidly on what happens at ASMFC, as she does with this New England Fishery Management Council. But only teasing, Janice. I had to recognize all the work that she's been doing for us in terms of outreach and communication of what we do at the interstate level and here at the council. I'm going to hit the highlights, skip lobster. I don't do lobster. I don't touch it with a 10-foot pole unless it's an bisque. I'll go to Terry or to Doug to cover those lobster-related issues. You're all aware, I believe, that Bob Beal is now the executive director of ASMFC. Bob has a lot of history with ASMFC. He's done a splendid job. He has been here at these council meetings off and on, so I'm certain that we'll continue to have a great working relationship with Bob as he explains what's happening at ASMFC and as he brings back to ASMFC council-related issues, concerns that ASMFC needs to address. In addition to that happening, that personnel issue, we had another award. We had an award given out. ASMFC presented George LaPointe with the prestigious Captain David H. Hart Award. It was an award that was established back in the early 1990s, and it recognizes individuals who have made an outstanding effort to improve Atlantic marine fisheries management. So, George was provided with that particular award, and it was well-deserved, to say the least. All right. Now, sea herring. We'll be dealing with sea herring a little later on in today's agenda. I'll only note that for Area 1A, which is where ASMFC spends most of its time, the section, ASMFC sea herring section, replicated, that is, went with status quo for the 2013 specifications for Area 1A. We also heard a report from our technical committee regarding what would need to be done in order for ASMFC to take a lead role in the protection of spawning sea herring in the Georges Bank area. I think this council is concerned about it. Certainly the states are. The states deal with spawning area closures right now in the Gulf of Maine, so why not on Georges Bank? Some good work was done by our technical committee. The pros and cons were highlighted. More work needs to be done, so they've been sent back to the drawing board to work on a little bit more so that perhaps in the near future ASMFC will be able to take on that role if this council and the National Marine Fisheries Service are unable to or unwilling to take on that responsibility. With regards to winter flounder, a species of great concern to this council, certainly, Gulf of Maine winter flounder notably, in response to increased ACL subcomponents for state waters for Gulf of Maine winter flounder because of the updated stock assessment, we did initiate an addendum. It did go to public hearing, and the states did agree to increase the trip limit up to 500 pounds and also to do away with the recreational season restrictions. This is for the Gulf of Maine. And this would only be until June 1, 2013. All right, so this is basically a work in progress. The states are certainly very respectful of what this council is doing with Gulf of Maine winter flounder, and why wouldn't we be? There's Terry Stockwell, there's Doug Grout, there's myself, there's Mark Gibson, and there is Mark Alexander. So obviously we're part of this process, and we respect what needs to be done. So with that said, we decided to initiate another addendum that actually would put us in a much better position as a group of states dealing with Gulf of Maine winter flounder to be adaptive and to implement some accountability measures. Certainly when the Groundfish Committee report is given, you may hear, probably will hear, concern expressed by the committee and certainly by the advisors about states needing to have accountability measures. So this draft addendum that is being put together will propose output controls for Gulf of Maine state waters for the commercial and recreational fisheries to stay within the annually established state waters harvest limit. trip limits, size limits, area closures, seasons, possession limits, you name it, it's all there on the drawing board. So that's what's being worked on now. I mean, we expect that that draft addendum will be released fairly soon, maybe next month, and then we'll have public hearings. So we are responding collectively to this council's concerns about Gulf of Maine winter flounder and the industry's concerns as well. All right, that covers Gulf of Maine winter flounder. All right. Skip over a lot of this since it's not really of interest to this council. Sturgeon. Sturgeon is of great interest to this council. Obviously, we need to deal with what the National Marine Fisheries Service did regarding the listing of sturgeon. And let's see, it's threatened in the Gulf of Maine, endangered to the south, mid-Atlantic, southern New England waters. The states have taken a great exception to that. We disagree strongly with that particular NOAA fisheries decision, but it's a done deal. So what we did at our meeting was to review and discuss a draft delisting and downlisting petition. That's what we charged our technical people to put together, working with the plan development team of ASMFC dealing with sturgeon. But the board decided not to move that forward yet. Instead, we have postponed moving that forward until after we get an update on the stock assessment timeline and then the required scientific support regarding the sturgeon status of the sturgeon stock. So it's that's on hold for now, but certainly that will be moved forward relatively quickly as soon as we get that stock assessment information. And then finally, spiny dogfish. The Spiny Dogfish Board, which is actually the Dogfish Coastal Sharks Management Board. We approved quotas for the 2013-14, 14-15, and 15-16 fishing season. We did that, and we also went with a maximum possession limit of 4,000 pounds per day. It seems that we're all going to be on the same page, both councils and ASMFC, on spiny dogfish with the National Marine Fisheries Service, I believe, also being supportive of this particular decision. The quota is, well, for the upcoming season, 2013-14, 40.842 million pounds, and as I said, the 4,000-pound trip limit. So all seems to be well with spiny dogfish, and I'll just highlight one stock status, a bit of stock status information, because this is important, and we always forget this. I do, and I need to be reminded every once in a while. The spawning stock biomass is estimated to be 475 million pounds in 2012, and it has exceeded our target of 351 million pounds, and that's happened for the last 5 years. But we always forget is that that's for spawning females, only for the females, not for the males. When you look at mature male abundance, male dogfish abundance, the biomass of dogfish just goes through the roof, and it's almost incomprehensible. But anyways, food for thought for this council and for the mid, and this has been discussed before, if we were to actually have a fishery that would target the male dogfish, it's very likely we could have a quota far in excess of what we have right now. Although, admittedly, what we have right now is difficult for the processors to even handle because of a lack of market. Market demand is there, but it's getting into the markets and then increasing the demand even more than it is right now. That's the issue. So all seems very well with spiny dogfish, which, as we know, is a major predator of sea herring and also on cod and everything else on the ecosystem off of our coast. So that concludes my report, except for lobster.
Doug, would you bring us up to speed on lobster?
I'd be glad to, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Probably the one item that is most interest to the council here is that our board initiated development of Addendum 20 to formalize measures outlined in the agreement between the offshore lobster fishery and the sector lobster fishermen for bottom sharing in closed area 2 of Georges Bank in order to prevent gear conflicts and to protect large concentrations of egg-bearing females. I want to personally commend the two organizations, the leaders of those fishermen, for being proactive and getting out and coming to an agreement. and bring that to the commission so that we could start the process of implementing that. And as you will probably, you all know that the in Framework 48, we passed a measure for inclusion in there where we'll be sector requests. When considering sector requests for access to closed areas, the regional office should also consider lobster and gear conflicts and protected species in there. So I think we're all working on the same page here, and I commend both organizations for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last Friday, the Northern Shrimp Section approved Addendum 1, which implements a number of new management measures into the FMP. The highlights of the addendum include replacing the soft tack with a hard tack to be set annually between the target and threshold during the annual spec process. A new closure process to close at 80 to 95% of the projected landings instead of the conference call process, which we had quite a conference call this last spring. A gear allocation of 87% to the trawl fishery and 13% to the trap fishery beginning this season, in consideration of a limited entry program and another action. As Bill indicated, the shrimp forecast is not very robust for this year, but the section will be meeting on December 3rd in Portland, Maine, to set the specs for next season.
Questions for anyone on the reports? Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Recall at our last council meeting, I mentioned the fact that we should look at protecting spawning biomass. It seems to me over the years we've evolved. I remember initially in talking about our initial herring plan that we developed, we chose not to protect spawning herring because I recall the Science Center said if you're managing under the MSY rules, you don't need to specifically address protection for spawning biomasses. And at the last council meeting, I mentioned, you know, we need to look at, there may be instances of overall stock biomass that it would be critical that we protect spawning biomass. So Dr. Pass brings up a great point about why is the ASMFC looking at, again, protecting spawning biomass of herring in the EEZ on Georgia's banks like they do the Gulf of Maine. And I would suggest that we task our PDT to look at the importance or lack of importance to protect spawning biomass in the EEZ as part of our, you know, herring mandate.
Mary Beth?
Did Dr. Pierce report that's what the commission is going to do? Did I miss that? They're going to initiate an addendum to protect spawning biomass on Georgia's Bank?
The sea herring section a few months ago indicated that it wanted to address the issue in some way, but first we needed the tactical committee to work on it to see what would have to be done, also to come up with the costs of doing that. There are a lot of issues that need to be addressed, so that work is still ongoing, with there being no decision yet by the council, by the commission, to implement those spawning closures, although there are many members who would like to do it, but it's still subject to what we get from our technical committee as to its feasibility, and with the number one issue being how much it would cost to pull it off.
Mary Beth.
Just to follow up in general, the idea of protection of spawning stock biomass or spawning fish of herring, some of that is a science discussion and some of that's a policy discussion. There are many, many directed fisheries around the world on herring for roe, including in the United States. So it is quite possible to direct fish on spawning stock biomass for herring. And you do have to take that into account when you consider what the total removals from that stock could be. But it's certainly very doable. It's not the strategy that we've chosen to do here in this region, but just as a blanket statement that you need to protect spawning herring, that's clearly not the case, and some of that's policy.
Matt, did you have your hand up? Okay. PK?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Pierce, what was the rationale for waiting on delisting the sturgeon? Was it because you were waiting for the stock assessment to have further ammunition to help along the delisting? Because it just seems like delisting will take a long time, and do you have any idea on how long that could take?
The sturgeon board understands that to delist or downlist, well, it'll be a very difficult undertaking that will require, unfortunately, a lot of time. It's basically the service did it, and now we have to respond. It will take time, it will take energy and effort, but the only convincing way we can move forward, that is to move this forward with some chance of making a successful argument, is to have that stock assessment information in hand, because we really haven't had an updated stock assessment in many, many years. And yet the state biologists who were involved in sturgeon work are quite convinced that the abundance of sturgeon up and down the coast is far higher than what that abundance is believed to be as put forward in the rationale by the service for listing sturgeon. So that work is hopefully on a fast track. That is, the stock assessment work is on a fast track, because everyone realizes that the states, the fishing industry, everyone will now be heavily burdened by our having to deal with the listing of sturgeon.
Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Paul Howard's made a great point. I recognize that the decision whether to protect spawning herring is at least in part a policy decision, but certainly has aspects of ecosystem science and population dynamics. But I think we've made the management decision. We've certainly made it in the Gulf of Maine, where we protect spawning herring. I think extending that to Georgia's Bank spawning aggregations would just be an extension of what we've already recognized, which is that spawning herring are important. I think the reason we didn't do that originally, or that decision wasn't made, was that that portion of the stock was underutilized in the past, and that the offshore component, there was a management decision made to encourage more fishing in those areas. But we're above the sub-ACL in those areas now. So I think there is a real reason to take another look at spawning protections in Georgia's Bank, and I definitely support tasking the PDT to do that at the next appropriate time.
Dave Gaethel.
No. On that discussion, I would say I think it should stay with the states. The federal process isn't remotely agile enough to deal with the fact that herons spawn at different times of the year, every year. Even the state process isn't agile enough. Witness what happened in the western end of 1A again this year. Closed too early, the fish weren't spawning. Open too early, the fish were spawning. 2 weeks later, it closes again. But the states have a far more agile process than the federal government will ever have. It's going to be formulaic if it's done by the feds, and it'll be wrong, I guarantee it. But I did have a question, not on herring, but actually on a sister fish, shad and river herring, in the report, Dave. I noticed a number of states have programs approved for shad, some for river herring, some for both. What is the status now of management programs in shad and river herring throughout the range of the AFMFC? Have they all got some kind of management program in place that's been approved, or are there still a number of states that don't have anything approved?
My understanding is that those states that wish to bring forward a sustainable fishery plan can do so, and then it has to be approved by the technical committee. Not everyone has done that. Some states have. But it has to be a very robust plan. It has to be very very demanding in terms of protection for river herring and shad.
Okay. I saw a number of hands go up, so I assume other people want to respond. But for the states that haven't done this, what happens there? I mean, given that we're going to spend probably a good portion of the afternoon on shad and river herring, I need to know what is being done on a state-by-state basis, since everybody has to land in a state. Whatever we do is the feds is a little bit irrelevant because you have to land in a state. There is no federal landing port.
Terry, did you have a comment for this?
Yeah, a quick follow-up to Dr. Pierce. Essentially, the shad and river herring fisheries are shut down. The only way you can conduct a fishery is through a sustainable management harvest plan, which has to be forwarded to the technical committee first and then reviewed and approved by the board. State of Maine has one for river herring. We've closed all our rivers for commercial fishing with the exception of the municipal river fisheries that are well up inside the headwaters. They're annual fisheries under both state and commission review. We file an annual compliance report and a report with the commission, so that it's pretty tight. We do have a provision in our landings program for a percentage of bycatch to come in from federal waters, which is consistent with the Commonwealth, and I'm not sure of however many other states.
Doug, did you have more comments on?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. You know, and it can be different with the different species. New Hampshire has an approved sustainability plan for river herring, but is choosing to have the state close to the take of shad. And possibly, if it would be helpful, we could talk to the plan coordinator there and try and get a list of what states have approved plans for shad and river herring and which states are going to be closed beginning in 2013, if that would be helpful. And the only thing I'd ask is, do you want to just have that information for the Northeast here, or do you want it coastwide?
Dave?
I think it would be helpful to have it coastwide, especially with the herring fishery extending quite a way south and landing ports all the way down to Virginia, potentially. But I do take from what David said, the essential point is that if you don't have one of these plans, then it's zero. That's correct. That's really what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Mark, did you have any comments on that?
Well, I think maybe Dave just came to the answer he wanted to, but just summarize for Rhode Island, we're one of the states who just received approval through the commission for the framework of a sea herring management plan in state water, effectively in state waters, that has river herring elements to it, because we were one of the states that simply had a prohibition on possession in state waters. So what we have proposed to the commission, and what we are actually in public hearing mode right now, and we'll go before our own Marine Fisheries Council on December 3rd, is a proposal that would allow federally permitted vessels that had fished in federal waters to transit either through Rhode Island or land in Rhode Island with a 5% tolerance of river herring on board. Previously, they were prohibited from possessing any. So we have proposed that. We have also proposed a program by vessels fishing in state waters would have to have a permit from my agency. And a condition to that permit were, in addition to being properly licensed, that they are capable of receiving the SMAST hotspot data. And only under those conditions would they be permitted to fish in state waters, and there would be move-along levels consistent with the SMAST, essentially as traffic light approach, green, yellow, and red, and they would be receiving that information, and when hotspots popped up, individuals fishing in state waters would have to move away from those hot spots. And if they did not do so, then their permit would be revoked. That's the essential. We're trying to get our sea herring program accredited right now relative to river herring. We have not proposed opening the runs themselves to exploitation, but that could come at another time.
Matt.
Just to bring this conversation back to sea herring spawning stock. I think this question raises a really important issue that we'll be speaking about later today, Mr. Chairman, and that is the importance of development in ABC control rule. I think if we could fold the question of spawning stock protection into that, that might help us both kill two birds with one stone, so to speak, but also makes a more effective and predictable tool that will move forward in the long term for the industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else on this? Okay, that concludes our reports section. And just before we take a break, I had just wanted to... Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't have a comment relative to the commission report, but just to backtrack to your report on the executive committee briefly, I somehow missed under your item number one, discussion of timelines and management actions that is relative to habitat. And I think that this discussion about what that means, if the way I read it, it seems a very different outcome from the motion that I made in September relative to habitat. And so I wouldn't propose that we get into that now. It has a lot of implications for both the scallop and groundfish industry members who aren't here. But I would suggest we add this to our agenda at some point during the week, because the way I read this is quite different than I think the expectation was following my motion in September.
Chris.
I need to bring the council's attention to the fact that there is an annual monitoring report under the SCAPE tab. There's no unexpected information in the monitoring report. However, it is a regulatory requirement that we produce a report and determine whether there's that the PDT make an initial determination on whether or not AMs would be triggered. So just to beat that regulatory requirement, I'm alerting you to that fact.
Okay. Just before we take a break, I wanted to give you a couple of thoughts as we look ahead at all of the work that we've got to get done, not only this year, but looking at next year. I have a couple of quotes from Calvin Coolidge. The first one is, we cannot do everything at once, but we can do something at once. And the second one is, when you don't know what to do, do the work in front of you. We'll take a break and come back at 11:10. 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10, 11:10,